Thank you, Michael. Our last speaker for this afternoon is Dr. Idawale Troutman. Dr. Troutman identifies himself through his commitment to social justice, human rights, community activism, health equity, and national and global health. His life work has been a testimony to this fact. Dr. Troutman has over 40 years of dedication through ASHRAE to the principles of universal freedoms and the elimination of racism, injustice, and oppression. His unique educational background has been a major factor in this quest. He has an MD from New Jersey Medical School, a Master's of Public Health from Columbia University, a Master's in Black Studies from the State University of New York in Albany, and as of October 2009, board certification from the National Board of Public Health Examiners. He is residency trained, a family physician, graduating from residency at the Medical University of South Carolina. His careers included clinical emergency medicine, hospital administration, academic and public health practice. He served as an associate professor at the University of Louisville's School of Public Health and Information Science while directing Metro Louisville Department of Public Health Wellness. Dr. Troutman has multiple publications, including What If We Were Equal, co-authored by including What If We Were Equal, co-authored by former Surgeon General and Assistant Secretary of Health, Dr. David Satcher. His awards and recognition include the MediStar Physician of the Year Award, the St. Stephen's Community Man of the Year Award, the Oddenheimer Award for Social Justice, the Poverty and Stroke Award, and numerous others. Most importantly, he is the President-elect of the American Public Health Association. Please help me welcome Idawale.
So the challenge of being the last speaker is always a difficult one. You sit there and you say, okay, I don't need to do that. I can know that slide. No, I can't. So my 20-minute plus presentation is about 3 minutes at this point. great presentations, I'm sure you'll agree with me. And what I decided to do with this presentation is to summarize some things that we all talk about, like what is health equity, what's an inequity, what is social determinants, and then quickly go to the work that I was involved in Louisville as director of their health department for 7 or 8 years or so. And then finish up with some questions, which I think are important. I know you are going to be asking us questions, but I'm asking you questions as a part of this presentation when we get to that. So going back to my friend Albert Einstein, the reason I have this slide is it's interesting. We had this conversation in the previous session about the medical model and not talking at the medical model like it's an adversary. Nonetheless, I think that one of the things that he's quoted or paraphrased as saying is, continue to do the same thing in the same way and expecting a different result means you're out of your damn mind. So for me, the notion that we have this gap in excess death that has existed minimally, if you just take popular writing since 1899, when W.B. Du Bois wrote The Philadelphia Negro and talked about the differences in health between those two populations, minimally 113 years we've had this problem of a gap in excess death, and it's still there, and in many instances it's growing. That's because we're out of our damn minds, because we think we can make a difference and close the gap by the medical model. And I think it's important to recognize we don't need to be an adversary to the medical model, but the medical model is not going to close the gap in excess death. It has to be one based upon social justice and the notion of human rights. Well, thank you very much. I should sit down at this point because I'm now ahead of the table. this is a review slide for me always. I think extremely important is the issue of how we frame what it is we're talking about. So reframing of the issue determines your resources, allocations, the direction you're going, your analysis. When you've in fact achieved what you want to achieve, it becomes a very critical, important part of the work. And my slide presentation should be, well, it's not on the flash drive because I was delinquent in getting it in on time, but it's certainly going to be available for you if you want to focus on that. And I just listed a whole series of reframing issues which I think are important to the work without going into each one because we don't have enough time. But on the very top of the list is this notion of health versus healthcare. And we all know if you go out on the street and even among some of our colleagues in the medical profession and you ask them about health, their answer is healthcare. That's all they see. the very small component of the bigger notion, which is overall health, which is about socioeconomics, transportation, housing, where you live, green space, access to non-discrimination in housing and jobs and so on and so on and so on and so on. So that notion of how we frame this becomes an important when you look at health versus healthcare. You can take your pick as to which one of these are most important in your own mind. I like to talk very quickly about market justice versus social justice, and my colleagues often tell me market justice is an oxymoron because there is no justice in the market. The market is about profit, bottom line. It doesn't really care very much about what happens to people as long as there's profit motive at the end of the day. Health equity versus health disparities is an important one to me as in terms of this notion of reframing, because when you look at the purity of the definition, even though disparities has been expanded to try to change it, disparities means differences, period. So there are differences in health that are not necessarily a result of the way the world is built, as in I'm 66 years old, my health is not going to be the same as my 25-year-old child. That's a disparity, it's a difference. I prefer to use inequity, and I'll go into the definitions in a few minutes, because that is much more profound and clear in terms of what it is we're talking about and what we're trying to do. Two definitions, and again, I'm sure you know this, but I felt duty-bound to put it up whenever I have an opportunity to talk about this. This is a large definition. It's been narrowed somewhat by CDC and others. I prefer to go back to the root. This is a composite definition that was put together by people all over the country talking to each other and figuring out what this thing meant called health equity. And it says that health equity is the realization by all people, and there's WHO language throughout this, of the highest attainable level of health. Achieving this requires valuing all individuals and populations equally and entails focused and ongoing societal efforts to address avoidable inequalities by assuring the conditions for optimal health for all groups. That's CDC language again, mixed in particularly for those who have experienced historical or contemporary injustice or socioeconomic disadvantage. Great definition. I hope that you agree with me. This is one that helps to be very clear about where we're trying to go with this. And the second, which is the flip side, why I prefer inequities versus disparities as a term, because it says clearly in red that they are systemic, avoidable, unfair and unjust, and I would add unnatural, differences in health status, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, sustained over time and generations and beyond the control of individuals. So it puts it squarely in the ballpark of societal effort, organized response. Medical model is not going to close the gap, is not going to eliminate inequities, although a lot of them are based upon what happens in the medical environment. And I spent 15 years running an emergency department in Newark, New Jersey, so I have a field of experience that speaks to that, an awareness of that elite. A summary of what is human rights, and the previous speaker, I'm very happy to talk about the fact that health is a basic human right. I'm sure most of us in the room, if not all, believe that. This is a summary of what that entails. I found over the years in doing talks that the language that we use often is not connected to all of us the same way. So when I say health, you think this, you think that, you think the other. When I say human rights, you think this, you think that. This is a summary from the United Nations and others that human rights are universal. That's, you know, this it means because we are human beings, we're entitled to that, and no other reason is necessary. Safeguarding dignity and equal rights of everyone, inalienable, can't be taken away. Interdependent, and this was referenced, I think, in Barbara's talk, that if you abridge one human right, you abridge all human rights. You cannot separate them from one from another. They're entitlements and internationally guaranteed and legally protected. That's the summary statement for what human rights are. And I put this one up. I love this. This is the Constitution of Ecuador. And, you know, when you look at a constitution as a philosophical and foundational element of who your society is, and it says the state guarantees the right to health, its promotion and protection, this is all public health language throughout this, through development of food security, provision of drinking water, basic sanitation, healthy family, work and community environment, and the possibility of permanent and uninterrupted access to health services in conformity with the principles of equity. The Constitution talks about equity, my God. Universality, solidarity, quality, and efficiency, some of the things that were just mentioned in the last comment. So what a model of a constitution. Further, the nation of Ecuador has gone about creating federal law to support the constitutional direction that they chose to go. Now, they're not where they need to be or where they want to be, but that's the direction that they want to go. This is from a WHO report several years ago now that says social justice is a matter of life and death, enough that we should believe that. It affects the way people live, their choice of a chance of illness and risk of premature death. And I'm from the Bronx, and I talk fast anyway, but I know I'm on a time limit. If you're a Star Trek fan, I'm on Warp 9 on the curve. I've got to take 2 minutes and do this justice. We all refer to upstream. Many have not seen the metaphor of upstream, downstream. Very quickly, let me tell you what it is. You know, and I've developed this over time, the understanding of what people do when they fish. I say that there are two people standing on the bank of the river fishing. I originally said they were drinking brandy, and people laughed at me because nobody drinks brandy when you fish. So they're standing there drinking a Bud Light. And the baby floats down the river, and they're shocked. And before they can do anything, a second baby floats down the river. And you know the story. The first guy throws the fishing rod down. He jumps into the water to save the babies. The second guy throws the fishing rod down, turns, and starts running upstream. And the first guy calls the second and said, "Man, where are you? I need you to help me pull the babies out of the river. Come back." He says, "No, I'm going up the river to find out who's throwing the babies in the river and stop them." That's the upstream, downstream metaphor. And in the context of our work, the babies in the river represent the 83,000 African Americans who die in excess each year, the untold number of Latinos, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, poor whites, et cetera, the systems that are based upon reactionary proposals rather than constructive, preventive, good promotion, health promotion organizations, and social justice principles. That's what's in the river. Going upstream is about finding the social determinants. Nancy, our colleague Nancy Krieger, the causes of the causes, the web of causation, who built the web, the spider, and in her diagnosis, in her analysis, the spiders are socioeconomic deprivation, gender discrimination, and institutionalized racism. Those are the three things that Nancy Krieger says as a social epidemiologist. If we could address those, we would close the gap in excess death and be about social justice. This is the list. Not going to go through all that. Obviously, you've seen this before. Note on my list, I agree with completely with Barbara. Racism, discrimination, housing, political power are all social determinants, structural factors that, in fact, we have to find a way to address if we're ever going to be about closing the gap and bringing about health equity. I'll spend the next several minutes on this. This is the Center for Health Equity at Metropolitan Louisville. It was the first of its kind to be opened at a local health department in the United States, and very proud of that. It's right in the middle of the West End, which is the African-American community in Metropolitan Louisville. I put this up not because it's a pretty picture, but to show you that leadership and community involvement is extremely important in any effort of this nature. Starting on the far left is the mayor of Metropolitan Louisville. The two people next to him are people from the Neighborhood Association. The young lady dressed in African attire is the chair of the Neighborhood Association. Behind him is the council person from that district. There's myself and the new director for the department. And behind the pole, you can't see him, is the former executive director for Nature, who came down for the opening of our center. This is the mission statement for the center. Notice that it's not providing health education to the community. It's building a civic process that builds social engagement, autonomy, and movement to strengthen communities and influence public policy in an effort to create health equity. That's what the center is created to do, and is still in existence after many, many years now. Some of the things that the center's been doing, how's my time, Mel?
You're doing fine.
Mel says I'm doing fine. Okay, so I can slow down a little bit. I have a couple of slides that just kind of point out some of the things that the center has been doing since its opening. I've left a year and a half ago. So I've updated one or two things that they're currently engaged in. But one of the first things we did was framing research. We said if we're going to take this notion, this message of health equity and be about integrating it into our community, we need to understand people's perception of the things that we do and the notion of health equity. We did some framing research that gave us some valuable information in terms of what the community believes. We did find that the community at large did not believe, or I should put it this way, the community at large felt that if you have bad health, it's because you made bad choices. We found a general lack of understanding at the community level of this principle of social justice, health equity, structural factors, the notion that if you make a bad choice around your nutrition, it's partly because there's no place for you to get adequate nutrition at a price you can afford because of food deserts. But that was something that didn't, that at that point in time, we found a gap between what we believed was going to be understood and what in fact is understood by our community. A series of health equity community hearings was agreed to, upon to be launched with the support of the Board of Health. We did in fact do a series of mini grants designed to engage the small community-based organizations that didn't have the resources that they might want. And these mini grants were specifically designed to have them focus on issues that we perceived were health equity issues. But the kinds of things that came back were very gratifying. One of them, for instance, was a grant that we gave to the law school to work with a group of African-American teenagers in a high school around land use. What a revolutionary idea for high school kids and lawyers to work around land use from a public health department funding. There was also one that was used to hold a conference on poverty amongst African-American women by a community group. The speaker series ran for a couple of years, bringing in noted individuals from around in the country who were addressing health equity issues to be present for what turned out to be mostly an academic audience, which I think was probably a mistake on our part. I think we could have done a better job in bringing in speakers who are more attuned to the needs and the interests of the community. Some of the presentations I felt were a bit too academic for what we were intending to do, but you learn from your mistakes. We did institute some web-based learning for the people in the health department. This next one is extremely important, and I think Barbara mentioned that in another context, retraining the workforce. So we noticed that the notion of operationalizing health equity within the Department of Public Health was a critical element for us to do. Now, there are a couple of ways to do this. I chose to take the notion of my leadership and the bully pulpit as the director of the department to require that everybody in the department go through a series of trainings based upon understanding health equity, social justice, and the differences in health outcome. Now, you might say that was an autocratic methodology and that's not democratic. I didn't really care. In my opinion, I said, if we're going to be in this process and doing this work, then I need to make sure at least that everybody in the department has been exposed to this material in the same way. So I personally ran the trainings myself for every person in the department. I got all kinds of interesting responses, some that were not, you know, really cool, but that's okay. Another way of doing this was something that was pioneered by Doak Bloss up in Michigan, and that's a dialogue process, where he worked from the other direction. He worked to get members of the department together and have them come up with the notions of health equity and social justice through dialogue over a long period of time. And I think I was a little too impatient, wanting to make sure that at least had the basic elements of the work done and everybody had a chance to see the same stuff. We did, in fact, have several workshops on undoing racism supported by the People's Institute. But if you've ever worked with the People's Institute, you know it's fairly expensive and we couldn't do as much as we wanted. They cost us like $15,000 a workshop, and you didn't get that many people in the room. But it was very powerful training, in-your-face, confrontative, about 2.5 days. And in those sessions, we had not only public health workers, we had police, we had fire, we had politicians, we had, you know, just folk from the community, all looking at this issue of undoing racism together. We just did our second health equity summit in partnership with a health system, Norton's Health System, a hospital-based system in metropolitan Louisville, that agreed to partner with us to do health equity summits. We did two great photo voice projects at least. I'm sure they're still doing them, and I didn't put the slides up because we don't have enough time. But the two were very, very quickly. One was with youth, kind of a youth empowerment model, where we met with kids, 10-year-old kids, and we talked with them about community health. And I have 5 minutes left. We talked about community health with the kids, not in terms of a directive telling them what it is, but in terms of trying to elicit from them what their sense of community health was. And then we gave them cameras and asked them to go out and take photos. Those photos were then put on the billboards and shared with the members of the city council and the mayor's office, getting them a sense of what kids see and how the kids can be involved in empowering community. The second one, we started a Black Men's Health Project called AMEN, which stands for African American Male Empowerment Network. And through that process, we did a photo voice project with men who had just come out of the criminal justice system through the drug court. And the notion was, what is it that they wanted to say? What was going to be their focus? And interestingly enough, they came up with the notion that, look, we're felons. We did our time. We went to jail. We finished that. We want our rights back. We can't vote. We can't do this. We can't do this. And they started organizing a statewide effort to have men organized around the advocacy for changing the law in the state of Kentucky to give them back their rights. I haven't checked back in with them for a while, but one of my colleagues in the back in the red jacket, straight raise your hand. She was our primary evaluator for communities putting prevention to work, and maybe she knows the answer to that question. Jump down to CHI project was a project with a hospital-based system, encouraging them to help to find a way to partner with us to develop an instrument to check whether or not they are seeing differences in referral patterns based on race and ethnicity, similar to the unequal treatment piece that IOM put out several years ago. The food justice piece, based upon the notion of food deserts, some of our staff assisted in developing a food security task force, which turned into some policy changes. The racial healing grant that we actually had one from Kellogg Foundation, but we used it to work with youth. West End visioning process is part of a map design, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but that specific community was the African-American community in the West End. Amen, I mentioned. We actually worked with Jobs for Justice on some issues. One of the interesting stories about partnering with unusual in terms of not the normal partners, is that we partnered with a group that had, in fact, been organizing against the mayor some years before. So the mayor's office wasn't very happy about the fact that we were reaching out to these folks, but they had some really good work that they were doing. I think I'm going to, of unnatural causes, of course, if you've not yet seen this, shame on you. It's one of the things that you can use for community organizing, really, for community dialogue, to show this in all kinds of settings and engage in conversation, either through the curriculum that was produced by with NACHO and the California Newsreel, or using the community's involvement to create your own questions for dialogue and discussion. This is Healthy in a Hurry Corner Store, which came out of work with the YMCA and work on food deserts. You see the name of the store up there was chosen as a part of a contest with kids from a middle school around the corner. There's the mayor, the gentleman, the shorter gentleman is our congressman, Secretary Sebelius, and the woman in the blue shirt is the owner of the store. This is the corner store that never sold fruits and vegetables ever, 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 until we got involved with them. The money from the YMCA project bought the refrigeration unit in the back, the shelving material, and we connected them with the wholesale to get them a good price on fruits and vegetables. Then through Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant that we're successfully getting, there are now, Muriel, how many do we have now?
Seven.
There are seven of these now throughout the community. And there's a lot of stories that we can talk about that in terms of how you got to that point, what was involved in getting those individuals to agree to be a part of that process, et cetera. This is from last year. I lifted this off of the website. They came out, that's the day because I'm not there anymore, came out with a health equity report 2011. And this is the mission statement. The report was produced by the Metropolitan Division of Public Health and Wellness, Center for Health Equity. The Center for Health Equity works to address the root causes of health disparities. Shouldn't put that word in there. But I'm not there anymore. By supporting projects, policies, and research working to change the correlation between health and longevity and socioeconomic status. Now, I do want to just quickly go through a couple of the questions. This was on Barbara's slide. I'm not going to bother with that. She beat me to it. Did a really nice job in it, too. Health impact assessment, we talked about that. Let me just get to a couple of the questions, and then I'll sit down. Issue of structure and function in public health. That is to say that does your department or agency structured in such a way you can do this work? Or do you need to change it and find some other mechanism to do the work? Or is there something about the structure? For instance, Oakland, California, the Alameda County Health Department created a separate unit within the health department to address these issues in community organizing. We started a center. What are the other ways that this might be done, and what fits best in your environment? The importance of a commitment from the top of the organization. I can't emphasize that enough. If there wasn't a Barbara Ferrer, would Boston still be doing what they're doing? I don't know. There's the examples of this all over the country, the importance of commitment from the top of the organization. there was a dramatic underrepresentation, and I spent several years on the board of NACHO at people at the top, in local health department, in state health department, et cetera. You can count, I mean, I could probably sit in a NACHO meeting, a board meeting, and count on maybe two hands and 1 foot the number of health department directors who happen to be African-American or Latino. There's a dramatic need to change that if we're going to continue to be focused on this issue. What's happening at your local health department, is it symptomatic treatment or is it curative? Does it change the basic relationships in the community or ignore it? Does it focus on upstream or is it a continuation of business as usual, resulting in nothing but a healthier underclass in a society where social injustice flourishes and equity is a non-entity? How do you make radical change from within a static organization? How do we define success? What does health equity look like? What does social justice look like? Can you close your eyes and visualize it? If you can't visualize it, how do you make it happen? And last but not least, are we willing to take the risk? Because this is a risky business that we're in when you start talking about changing societal norms and changing structure. One of the questions that's not on here, but I'll leave this with you as I take my seat, can we in fact have health equity and social justice in a capitalist society where the bottom line is profit? This is from WHO, the last the slide that talks about this is all we have to do to bring about a better world. Improve daily living conditions, tackle the unequal distribution of power, money, and resources. That's WHO's talking. And measure and understand the problem and assess the impact of the action. Last but not least, know the difference between the battle and the war. So, yes, we now have 7 healthy and hungry corner stores, but have we changed the basic structure and relationship of that society? No. So we've won a battle, but the war is the bigger issue that we have to find a way to address. Thank you very much.
I want to especially thank our speakers, number one, for their outstanding presentations. They covered a lot of information in a very eloquent and insightful way. Importantly, they did that within time constraints that were unreal. Their presentations were timed for 25 minutes originally. They cut them back to 20 minutes and did it very effectively. However, we do have time now for dialogue, for questions, comments, and I recognize that although we have 3 leaders here at the table, we also have leaders in the audience as well. So at this time, if you would approach the mic and or if your voice is loud enough, you can speak from your seat.
First, I want to thank you. I just think all 3 presentations were outstanding. I've been less discouraged than I did before, which is very, very important. And I think I'm speaking for many of us. I want to add to the questions, actually. Our work at Prevention Institute is a lot on community determinants. And what is the link between the 7 corner stores and the broader change efforts? And when I think about the profit motive, I'm convinced more than ever was before, that the profit motive, particularly in health-related, that possible in health-related industries, which may be an oxymoron as a particular issue or concern. But I wanted to ask a hard question because I've been doing some writing, and as part of the writing, it's a book called Prevention Diaries, really aimed at the general public, and part of the writing is on equity. And when I started writing about equity, it related to the questions that the 3 of you talked about, which were primarily place-related changes, how to make changes that were placed. And as I got in deeper, I felt like it was unconscionable to write about equity without also talking about disability, without talking about gender, without talking about sexual preference, and a couple of other issues like that. And I'm a little unclear still about cross-cutting strategies and cross-cutting conclusions. You know, there are issues around dignity, there are issues around how the individual, the environment, the community all kind of contribute to being worn down. But I wanted to ask for some insight from the 3 of you, because I'm sure you've had some of those same kinds of questions.
I'm sorry. I've had good fortune sitting on the Citizens Advisory Committee for Health Week 2020, And the question of equity that came up often, not as often as I'd like it to happen, but part of what I see is we're in an evolution in terms of language and focus. There was a time when there was no discussion about the differences in health outcome by population at any level. Then the 60s came around and all the movement through organizations, agencies were pushing, you know, healthcare for all, the Black Panthers, the Puerto Rican group from New York, young lawyers who were talking about getting free of pre-clinics, focusing on issues. The 1985 Task Force report on Black Minority Health, and we started using terms like excess death and gap and health disparities, and then we evolved into talking about, in my opinion, health equity and social justice. But in the work of AB 2020, we got some pushback. The pushback came from a lot of African American and Latino organizations who said, you all are abandoning the issue of health disparities, which came to be known as one that's focused on race and ethnicity pretty much exclusively. You're abandoning us. And no, we're not abandoning that at all, but there's a recognition that there are other inequities by sexual orientation, by disability status, by gender, by location, rural versus urban. And we have to find a way to make sure that everybody is included in this work without losing the other focus, which is very, very valid, on race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. That's the part of the question that I wanted to address with you.
Yeah, well, and I really agree with that. And I think one of the themes that probably cuts across is trying to engage the community and get the community engaged and get people to understand the benefits of public health, the protections of public health, so that they can advocate together. And I think that's really the key, is that as you define inequity in broader ways, you increase the number of people who are advocating on behalf of a systemic sort of solution to these challenges. That's why I mentioned, to me, the world was kind of late to the table in terms of talking about inequities. And I brought to the table late, and that's why we're all there. I think that because rural communities are so connected to their legislators, in a way that other communities can't, because every state gets two senators, no matter whether it's a rural state or not, so they're disproportionately represented. By not working to engage rural, I think public health does that to its own peril. But that's just one group. Certainly, gay and lesbian groups are very powerful advocates. And every African American group is very powerful advocates. There are a lot of advocacy groups out there all working with their own issues and trying to bring everyone together to advocate towards the same goal. I think it's really how well she does.
So I'm
going to
probably be a little controversial. I guess it's something that I'm not sure I disagree, but I think I frame it differently. I'm very concerned about sort of the legacy of slavery and institutional racism, and so I can't help but want to make sure that as we do work around health equity, we acknowledge sort of that horrific history that still lives on in the foundational institutions in the United States. So while I think equity issues cross lots of other things or people or communities, I'm not convinced, no one has shown me evidence that institutionalized inequity exists at the same level it exists, particularly for people of color in the United States. And because of that, I would urge us to pay particular attention to issues of racism, which frankly, in this country, are the issues we least want to talk about and least want to deal with. And oftentimes, the pushback is driven by motives to not have to deal with both a horrific history, but also the continuation of institutional and systemic policies that really fundamentally create conditions for people of color like no other institutional policies exist around sort of rural groups or, you know, particular communities. I'll stop there. Because I know that's a controversial place to be, but, you know, we certainly at the health department get a lot of pushback within our own staff about why are we so focused on issues of racism. And that's the answer I like to put out there. That's why we're so focused. Because we have a very different history that's really built into our systems at this point that's going to take some special attention. Not that we shouldn't embrace other issues around building equity, and certainly I'm not trying to say that that's all we can do, but I am trying to say we need to pay special attention to this issue and not, you know, sort of get sidetracked, which I think unfortunately we have as a country very easily gone sidetracked.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Catherine Gray from the University of South Carolina School of Medicine, and I really enjoyed all three presentations today. They were fabulous. I did have a couple of questions and comments. For Barbara, I think what you're doing is fabulous, that you've got it kind of an infrastructure when you're talking about training. I made a note as far as that you are requiring input during the logic models to how it's going to be addressed, even down to the gardens that are being done. And I guess one of my questions is disability infused into that training, gardening, and all those concepts? Based on what you said, and some of the colleagues I have involved in, I would say probably so. I would say that people with disabilities are another one of those institutional policies that have historically and continue to be discriminated against. What I always encourage with, and I think that there's a huge overlap in everything, particularly in South Carolina where we have a large racial divide, is trying to make people understand that African Americans have disabilities at a higher rate than South Carolina. And so we're trying to pair and say, I promise I'm not trying to take money away from this side, I'm trying to, you know, cross it. As far as, I love some of the definitions in your presentation, because I think that's crucial for people. I think frequently we're not on the same page and we think we are, and that makes the conversation worse. One of the interesting things that we found when it comes to inequity, and I like that terminology for the same reason that you said, the definition is the help to the best extent possible. And I think one of the things that we have to recognize, at least we're seeing it in everything that we're doing in the state, is that society still thinks people with disabilities, maximum extent possible, is way lower than it is, and therefore they don't do. And I think so we have to step one more step back from the definition and say, what are all our preconceived notions when it comes to all the different minorities, so that we can move towards that, having that high expectation of everybody. So thank you.
My thoughts are very similar to hers. I'm from Southern California, Tony Sullivan. I am a retired nurse educator, dean, public health practitioner and advocate. And now most of the work that I do is the volunteer nature and tied in with Democratic politics, Democratic political activists. Can't wait to find out what happens on Thursday. anyhow, I love public health for Mrs. Fly. And, you know, to me, it's all about vulnerabilities. It's all about caring for the least of these and with social justice. And it's about social justice and it's about vulnerabilities. The most vulnerable, and I love that comment that you get it all down. I can't wait to get online and get the presentation the quotation by Hubert Humphrey from 1977 that was shown today was about the children and the elderly and the sick and the disabled and all of the above, the institutional racism. Look at Trayvon Martin, for heaven's sake. I mean, standing in place laws, if they are not a violation of public health, I don't know what I'm going to do. So anyhow, think about the vulnerabilities, whatever.
I just wanted to thank the person, the both of these speakers, but I particularly wanted to point out that I had a lot to learn about understanding the sort of institutional built-in discrimination for people who are living with challenges and disabilities. And you know, I'm fortunate because we just got a great disabilities commissioner in the city of Boston who's like completely opened our eyes and is really a very strong advocate for, you know, doing sort of what I say we have to do in public health, which is that, you know, her work has to be embedded in everything we're doing. And, you know, like, for example, we do, you know, when we do our community gardens now, we do have these sort of raised beds so that people who are in wheelchairs, for example, or elderly people who need to, you know, sort of be at a different level, can't really be bending down, can in fact work in the gardens. And, you know, that's nice to, you know, people like you, because, you know, able-bodied people, you know, again, white people, people with white skin, you know, we're all walking through the world, you know, with blinders on. We're walking through the world with blinders on, and we're not paying attention. And it's not until other people sort of raise our consciousness about what's really going on that we have to stop and rethink. And I think particularly for people in public health, you know, the most important thing we have to do is we have to start listening better. We have to start listening better. We have a lot to learn from other people who have been leading the battles around equity issues for a very long time. And just we have to sort of figure out how that gets embedded in our work now. But thank you for your comments.
Hi, my name is Terrence Roach. I work for YMCA USA, and I just wanted to applaud all of you for the great work that you've done and that you're currently doing as well. One of the most profound things that I heard from you all was really about the organizational transformation that especially moving around Boston. And one of my roles is to work with local YMCAs to help them change their organizational practices as well as work in the community. And I know, you know, in Louisville, Steve Tarver, you know, he has done that for his organization in a lot of ways, and talks about health equity. But my question is, outside of charismatic leadership and, you know, training all of your staff, it sounds like those are two things that have happened. What are some concrete things or strategies that you've used to change your organization? Particularly around the issue of race. I know I grew up in Boston. That was, you know, race is one of those issues that has historically been, you know, one of those things. So what are some concrete things outside of those two things that you can share with? Deeply ingrained biases in all of us in some strength.
expressing that in some way or shape or form. And to think that we can just make a change like that over a period of 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years, is not realistic. It's an ongoing process, which is one reason why I put what Dr. Ferrand say about the work they've done, because it's been quite an infrastructure, more so than we could do at Google. But I think that's a strong part of what needs to happen. Again, recognizing that you can't do it overnight. You're going to have resistance. Sometimes when I'm doing talks around the country, I have a question like, Dr. Trump, it's 2012. There's a black guy in the White House. Why are you talking about racism? So I feel really bound to just look at the calendar and say, well, let me see. The black folk came over here in 1619 on cruise ships from the Carnival Line. Won't work for me. And that was 1619, and then from 1619 to 1863 by virtue of Emancipation Proclamation in 1865, by the end of the war, we had the law of the land, institutionalized policy, the law was racism, was slavery by race. From 1865 until 1964 was the first civil rights legislation. You had the rise of the KKK, you had black codes, you had Jim Crow, you had the Chicken Determined Centuries, only to go to the death amongst black men. The segregation in the North, segregation in the South. 1964, civil rights legislation. From 1964 to 2012, it's 48 years. So I say, I'm going to help you eliminate 300 and some years of all that crap in 48 years. It's impossible. So racism is a part of the institutional structure, not key, but every organization in this country that's more than 5 years old. So you have to address it, and I think to the extent you can make that case, you can certainly get many people to come along. It doesn't going to resist forever, and so be it. The last thing I'll say about this is I'm a big Star Trek fan. There's a part of Star Trek, I forget which one it was, where there's a constant strife between Klingons and the humans, And Captain Kirk finally gets to the point where he says, our generation may have to die out before we can in fact have peace between us and the Klingons. And I think about this sometimes. I'm a kid who's, my orientation is solidly in the trife and turmoil of the 16,000 part of the Black Power Movement, African National Movement, people in the Panthers, the Nation of Islam. And maybe I'm still thinking of the 60s kid when I think about the magnitude of the issue of race and the way that discrimination in that space. Maybe I'm wrong, but maybe it's, I talk to some of the young kids sometimes and say, dude, what are you talking about? I just don't get it. Anyway,
I think that's really accurate. I've got concrete things that we've done that I can just put out that, whether they're helpful or not, I don't know. I'm going to start with money. Because, I have $154 million budget, so, I can complain all I want, and I can, what started when we first put our overarching goals, it was like, oh, if we get more money, we'll work on this. Like, we don't really have money in these areas. So, and it was an eye-opener when the budget period came around, and I was like, we have to work on these. And no, we don't have any new money, and that means taking money from something else and moving it. If these are our priority, these are overarching goals, they're our priority goals now, then we have to take the money we have, and we have to put it to doing this work. And I'm going to tell you, that changes everything. As soon as you start saying, the money that we have and the resources that we have to support the health equity agenda, everyone decides that, maybe I should pay a little more attention to this, because my money for my little program is going to get tied to how I'm contributing to building health equity. And that's a long process. It doesn't happen in one budget cycle. It's going to take us at least 3 budget cycles to get everybody to be able to look at their money differently. But I will say that's the goal. It's like, whatever money you have, if this is the priority, then just, we're all about prioritizing. That's what we all do every single day. We don't have enough money to do everything. We're constantly setting priorities. If health equity work is going to be the priority, then the money has to follow. And you have to find a way to to help to make get your money to work. Now, you know, I like that slide that showed that, you know, a lot of us get some city dollars, and for many of us, our city dollars tend to be our more flexible dollars. You know, I think that's where the challenge may lay for some people. I have a great mayor, and I can be very flexible, and when I decide that, you know, we're going to be able to support professional development training, and, you know, I have a lot of 24/7 services. So when I say I have to train all our EMTs and paramedics, I might have to pay them extra money. When I say I got to train all the shelter workers, that means that I got to pay people overtime to both cover shifts and to come in and do the training. So, you know, you have to say, like, this is really important. We're going to put the money here, and then, you know, because we're hoping that this training really leads to better practice. So you know, I can't say enough about, like, you got to look at the budgets, and you got to try to make those budgets line up with what you're saying are the priorities. I say it's equally important is accountability. If you want people to believe you, particularly the residents, the taxpayers, about the work that you're doing, then you have to, like everybody else, you have to be performance-based. You have to say, you know, these are my goals, and I'm going to reach them. And if I don't reach them, hold me accountable. And the goals need to be health equity goals. They need to be goals where you are explicit about narrowing the gap. Now, we did our homework. We looked at three goals where there's some evidence base to suggest that you could narrow the gap. You have to do things differently. But there was evidence or promising practices that we could, in fact, embrace that would let us get to a better place and narrow the gap. And, you know, so I think the accountability is really important. Little steps, you know. We talk a lot about resident engagement, like it's the cornerstone. So what does that mean if you're running a homeless shelter? It means you better at least have a resident advisory board. Like, you better at least start thinking on at very practical level, how does the consumer, the person who I'm giving services to, have a voice in this service? And when we're going up to talk to our legislators, we shouldn't be going up to talk on behalf of homeless people. We should be able to give homeless people training and skills and support, buses up to the state house, et cetera, so they can go up and talk. So, you know, those are little things, but I think they're real, and I think, you know, they can be done. And the last thing is, you know, the sort of, you know, try to you know, walk the walk, talk, whatever, walk. So, you know, having some group internally that's looking at your own policies, your hiring policies, your firing policies, your how positions, how people progress, you know, what does, you know, diversity look like? You know, we don't have any requirement at our agency that says, you know, you can't hire until you actually have interviewed a diverse pool of candidates. But we should have that. You know, those kind, I mean, people should start looking at what do we need to have to really make sure that, you know, we're able to encourage people to apply and then make it a welcoming and respectful environment so that people will stay. That means career ladders need to be clearly delineated, processes need to be much more open. So I can go on, but, you know, your HR policies, I think, another place people can.
And you know, one thing I'd like to add, we do a lot of public health services. And every time we find an innovative program, we ask the question, how much do we have almost in terms of experience in leadership? Some strong leader can. But leadership is a double-edged sword that kind of changes. So I think the key is to have a mentor and have those strong leaders who are going to implement those changes. But then you need to act with a sense of urgency and to institutionalize the changes. You need to get the staff trained. Get the funding dedicated. And then I think as importantly, we need to engage the community so they're not willing to accept anything less to make those programs harder to cut. And I think, you know, this is certainly true at the local level, but it's even more difficult at the state level where the leadership changes so constantly. And I think we're seeing a lot of states now that there's some very strong public health programs, public health systems are being somewhat dismantled because of changes.
We have time for one more question. Dr. Fine?
Thanks. Ollie Fine from Cornell, New York. I was wondering how many of the panel have actually read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow? Because it seems to me focus on the incarceration, particularly of young African-American men, is an extraordinarily important public health issue as well. And so I would ask you, Are there things that you've done? I mean, I was impressed, Adewale, that you did something about bringing together formerly incarcerated males to actually talk in terms of regaining their rights, because in fact that's one of the phenomena that you talked about, the real disenfranchisement of people who have been incarcerated. And I was wondering if that's happened at all in Boston, whether there's any emphasis within the rural setting around that issue and question.
I think we've done a fair amount of work because we did a lot of quarry reform, which involved working with other organizations in the city who actually were working both with recently incarcerated prisoners as well as people who have been recently released. We also run two re-entry programs. So we're sort of enmeshed in the issues. Those of you who know the homeless world in any urban setting, you know that there's a discharge to the streets. It's very common. So, we have 800-bed shelter that we're running, as well as a whole bunch of transitional programs. That's one of the reasons why this has become such a pressing issue for us is because of the work that staff were in fact doing and recognizing that, we have this huge problem. I will tell you, the other place where, for us it's been a really big part of our work has been we are partnering with some agencies and doing a program with gang involved youth. We actually are a training site at the organic farm out with our shelter that's a work program, and so we actually have gang involved youth down that actually train along with our homeless guests on this farm. And so we have a whole program for those targeted for about 250 youth that are most likely to either be victims or perpetrators of deadly violence in the city. And they're 100% gang involved, and they're 99% men, young men. And have gotten to know a lot of those young men, not only persons but our staff, because we do a lot of case management services with them. And again, they're in and out of the criminal justice system. And what we realized, and we're fortunate that we were working with the state on this, was there are no opportunities. So we've gotten money from the state to do job training programs and educational programs. So we contract with community-based organizations for these gang-involved youth who want to sort of try to do something different. But to do something different means a lot of services. They have problems with housing. You can't go into any kind of subsidized housing in Massachusetts if you have a serious criminal record. So, and you're making no money because you can't get a good job. And probably if you started young, which most of our gang involved youth, you didn't even graduate from high school and you don't have your GED. So there is a huge need for services to help people, especially young men, get back into being productive members. And they can't do it by themselves. I'll just be honest, they cannot do it by themselves. That would be completely impossible the way we're structured. So I think we're trying. I don't think we're not necessarily the lead on this, but we've been working a lot on partnerships. I think you're absolutely right. Look at the data in Boston, 1 out of 3 black men has spent some time in jail. I mean, that's an outrageous number. It speaks to a whole bunch of institutional and systemic racism issues, but it also speaks to the fact that we don't offer a lot of opportunities, so there's very high recidivism.
Mr. Meat?
I'm not aware of a lot in the rural community that's going on in this area. There are high incarceration rates in the rural areas, high poverty rates, and low educational attainment, particularly in that direction. But I think, Barbara kind of hit the nail on the head, the level of service that's needed to really serve the incarcerated population just isn't available in the rural community. I'm sure, there are thousands of rural communities, I'm sure some people are doing something, but I haven't heard of much.
Dr. Troutman.
Only to go back to the points that were really, really made. You start looking at incarceration rates and the new term over the last several years, the prison industrial complex, and the fact that small towns are in all over the country are anxious to get prisons because they make jobs and they bring revenue, and the product that they produce happens to be young black males. There's no way to describe it other than a prime example of racism, institutional, and Kamara Jones' 3 individually mediated, institutionalized, internalized racism as a part of that structure. And the notion that, as I mentioned in my slide, the notion that we're just going to have a healthier armed class is what the end result is of many of the policy and practice of segregation. Between it has to be a change in the structure of the system and the way things are organized and structured that put young blacks and Latinos in a position where they're going to be the ones that come to jail. This last Arizona law, even though they say, well, the ultimate is special administration, the notion that there's a law in place, or there's going to be, or there is a law in place, it's part of our Supreme Court, that says you can, if you arrest somebody, you stop on the street, you have a responsibility to find out if they're a citizen. Now you tell me, after a year of that, what's that group going to look like? It's going to be black and brown, and maybe a couple of whites who are unfortunately in the wrong place at the wrong time, who got stopped in question, but it's going to be another example of institutionalized racism in the law. And we have a dramatic charge to be a part of a social justice system that advocates revolution. I don't mean to say this mildly. I mean social revolution. I don't mean to take up guns and all that stuff. But I mean a revolution meaning a radical change in the way structures are organized and perpetrated in the country. It has to be a social movement. We need to find our place in that. Someone once said, well, public health needs to be involved in creating a social movement. No. We need to advocate and support it, but it has to be a grassroots social movement based upon the inequities that we see around us and the things that need to be changed in the structure.
This concludes our presentation and our session this afternoon. I want to thank the audience, first of all, for your attentiveness, and our speakers. Thank you.